Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Wednesday, January 19, 2022. It's a mild and rainy day here in Nashville. We are told to expect some snow in the overnight hours. Many of you know that one of my strong interests is genealogy and family history research. Of course, the research itself is rewarding, but I also have met some extraordinary people with family connections, and investigating family connections brings a richness to travel. It's one thing to travel to Germany just to see the sights. It's an entirely other thing to travel to ancestral villages in Germany and to meet up with a cousin who runs a vineyard there. And it is one such family connection which leads to our guest today, Irish author Derek Fay. Some years ago, I was working on the pedigree of my Irish-born great-great-grandfather, Michael Conway, and I discovered another researcher living in Dublin, Derek Fay, who was working on the same family. His dad's mother was also a Conway, also from the little village of Ballyjamesduff in County Cavan. And so we got in touch, and while we have never been able to establish on paper the pedigree connection, nonetheless, when we traveled to Ireland sometime later, we met up in person and had a delightful visit. And it turns out we may in fact be cousins on the basis of his DNA match to one of my known Conway cousins. So now my putative cousin Derek has published a fascinating book entitled Connecting a Nation, The Story of Telecommunications in Ireland. This book evidences a great deal of historical research, scholarship, and crafty storytelling. It was great fun to have a chat with Derek today about his new book, and I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Derek Fay. And by the way, this book is available to American readers through Amazon. And our interview with Derek Fay will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Derek Fay, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Derek, I'm terrific, and it's great to see your smiling face across the water.
Okay, you're welcome.
Derek, this is the very first venture for an international recording of a podcast for the Mark Fraley Podcast, so...
I feel honored.
Well, it's a terrific fun thing. And just to let my audience in on this, you're presently in Dublin.
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Derek, I want to talk to you and congratulate you on your new book, Connecting a Nation, published by the University Press there in Dublin. Correct about
yes,
that?
So it's published by UCD Press. The UCD stands for University College Dublin, which is the largest university in Dublin. It's sometimes overshadowed by Trinity College, which is longer established but actually smaller. And in fact, which is the university that I went to. But UCD Press is the press of UCD, which is actually the biggest university in the city.
Well, it's quite a handsome book. It is not a hard back book, but it is a very classy softback book, a very weighty and beautifully designed, a delight to read. And I'm wanting to get with you about that subject. But I want to share with our audience a little bit about how you and I got to know each other. It's a little bit outside of the scope of our podcast generally, which, you know, we generally talk about parks and conservation and ecological kinds of things. And this book is a little bit outside the realm of that. But this actually goes into a connection you and I made while researching our family history.
Yeah, that's correct. So we seem to have a shared ancestor from County Cavan, which is about 75 miles away from Dublin in Bally James Duff. My paternal grandmother was a Conway, and you have Conways on the...
That's right. My paternal grandmother was also a Conway. And of course, my Conways came to Ireland, came to the U.S., to Pennsylvania, more particularly, probably in the late 1830s, early 1840s. So they've been here quite a while. So any connection to the Conways back in Ireland is many generations ago. Yeah. But they are basically to that little town in County Cavan, Bally James Duff, yeah, which is on the eastern side of Cavan County, and quite a lovely place to visit. And actually the home of the Cavan Museum, which if you go to County Cavan to visit, you must see the Cavan Museum.
I don't think I've ever been in the Cavan Museum, despite obviously because of the family connection, having many visits to Cavan.
Well, it's really a cool little place. I think it used to be a convent, and it's been converted into a museum all about Cavan County, and you know it goes into the geographic and geological features of the county, and then the historical connections, of course, and they have a mocked up World War I trench exhibit in the back of the place, which is a full scale. You can walk around in the trenches as if you were in the World War I with the soldiers there to get the full experience of the Irish soldier in World War I, which of course is a point of concern for most Irish folks, that they were forced to fight for the British in that cause.
Well, I think forced is too strong a word, because conscription was not introduced here.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought they were conscripted.
No. So conscription was introduced in the rest of the UK. Ireland was part of the UK at that point in 1914 to 1918. But they decided, because of the national question, that it would cause more problems than it was worth to introduce conscription in Ireland. So because I just saw the war memorial, was there visited just with the dog for a walk on Sunday, and I think it's 45,000 Irish men died in the First World War. They were volunteers. I mean, they were, and they. I can remember talking to a very old gentleman when I was a kid who grew up very close to where I live here now in Dublin, and he could remember as a child the First World War, because there was a time of plenty in what was then a very poor part of Dublin, because the men were lots of young men had gone to war and were sending back a regular income.
I see. So interesting.
Yeah. And it's just part of Ireland's complicated history. So our relationship with those people who died, to some extent, when they came, because when the First World War was going on, was also the same time as the 1916 Rising, and a growth of following that, a big growth in nationalist sentiment. So a lot of the people who came back from war, having fought, they thought for Ireland, then were kind of shunned by Ireland, because they had kind of ended up on, public opinion had changed, and it was now much more strongly nationalist. And the people who'd fought for Ireland as part of the British Empire were now been shunned. And we had this rather uneasy relationship with the war dead from the First World War because of that.
So
it's
interesting.
It's really only in the last few decades that they've kind of been acknowledged.
So you and I met in connection with our family history, and I was, I guess on Ancestry.com, noticed that you had shared or taking advantage of some of the postings that I had posted on my account and communicated with you. And then not too many months later, Beth and I had the opportunity to visit in Ireland, and you were kind enough to join us in Cavan for a meal. And so we just, it really was a, it made our trip extra special to have that kind of personal connection with someone there. This is all to illustrate that you meet the nicest people when you do family history research, and I encourage everyone to dig into their families. I would say, though, that also that we've sort of have established a DNA connection between our U.S. Conways and yourself. One of my known Conway cousins in California matched you on DNA. So clearly we're cousins to some nth degree. I don't know what degree it might be, but we're going to work all that out on paper. I feel certain that we'll, with your research skills employed over there across the water, we'll probably get that all figured out.
Okay. That'll be my next project then.
Listen, if you take it up, it's going to be thoroughly researched, I can say. All right, let's talk about this book that you've done, and it's a marvelous book called Connecting a Nation, and it's all about the story of telecommunications and more broadly communications in general in Ireland, and it tells all the way from semaphore through telegraph to telephone to television and now to the internet, and it gives a lot of wonderful detail and interesting stories as each of those technologies was first introduced and then replaced by supplemented by others. What was your inspiration for doing this book, Derek?
Oh, I was always interested in kind of what do you call it, infrastructure, shall we say. So I've read books on, when I was a teenager, reading books about railways. There's a multitude of books on railways, even in Ireland, which is a small country, you know, there's a multitude of books out there. There's books on even the history of the electricity supply in Ireland. I think I have two books on the water supply in Dublin alone. And then got a job in telecoms started working in it in 1998. And, I thought, oh, this is an interesting area and whatever, and it's clearly having a big impact on people's lives. But when I went looking for a book about that, there was simply nothing. There was one or maybe a pamphlet produced by the incumbent phone company at the time, like more for schools, like an information kind of thing. But there was no history. And so that was lodged on my head for a while. And then about 3 years ago, I bumped into the neighbor from across the street. And I said, what are you up to? And she said, oh, I'm just finishing a book. I got a contract from, she mentioned a publishing company here, to write a book about the history of the Aran jumper, like an Aran sweater is. And I went, oh, that's interesting. And then I thought to myself, look, if there's a market for a history of the Aran jumper, there's a market for the history of telecommunications.
Absolutely.
So that inspired me. I just went, okay, this is now the time. And I started writing it 3 years ago. So it's been a 3-year project.
That was going to be the question, that 3 years is a lot of time to spend, and a lot of details in this book. Dates and times and people.
Yeah, I suppose it was partly helped by lockdown, actually, because there wasn't a lot to do since March 2020, all our lives got a lot quieter, and there was a lot of time spent, in the evenings, and so rather than took into endless Netflix series, I just knuckled down and finished this off.
So were you able to do the research there from home, or were you given permission to get into the library occasionally?
What had happened was that I'd started the research, and I, obviously before anybody had ever heard of COVID, and I had been to libraries, so I was back in the library in Trinity College where I had studied, and I had a graduate, I could get a graduate card to get into the library, and that's a copyright library, so they have they are legally entitled to every book that's published in Ireland or Britain, which means that they have almost everything published in these islands, and then they may buy stuff from other countries as well. But so it's a very good resource to have. So I used there and on the public library. I used a lot of archives and so on. And I had a lot of the base material ready for the earlier chapters up to the kind of maybe up to the 1950s, 1960s. And at that point, then lockdown hit. And I kind of at that point went, okay, I probably have enough base, a lot of the base material. Why don't I go start looking for personal stories? So I put some messages up on different internet forums, and I did get some good little anecdotes back, and then I was able to work, meld those two together. Libraries did reopen eventually, and archives and so on, and I was able to fill in the gaps, and that was that. So I had a trip to Oxford in this June to get material related to the 1916 Rising, because in fact the Bodleian Library attached to the University of Oxford, that's where the records, bizarrely, that's where the records for the police. So the switchboard in the central police station in Dublin, they've ended up in the Bodleian Library in Oxford for some reason, which I to do with the man who was in charge of it at the time, who's obviously British, and he donated all his papers. He took them with him personally, and then donated all his papers to Oxford. So I was over there for a day researching. Fascinating, because it's a little social history in itself, because there's basically a revolution happening in the city, and people are ringing the police to sort of say, this is happening, this is happening, I can't get food. There are bodies, there's a surgeon who phones the hospital, phones from the hospital to say, there are bodies piled up here. What are we to do with them?
Speaking of Belfast,
No,
no.
this is the 1916 Rising was in Dublin.
In Dublin, okay. Okay.
Yes,
Well,
yeah.
see,
So it was it
I
was
get confused of all these things. You
Yeah, no,
guys
I
rising up all the time over there.
The 1916 Rising is taken as kind of the start, what the star, well, what really the turning point that made Irish independence reality. And it was in Dublin, and it destroyed a chunk of the city. Was it took until really the late 20s for it to be rebuilt. Anyway, so it's quite a turning point in Irish history. So the but one of the important things was that the rebels, they didn't take over for the telephone exchange. So they did disable some telecommunications, but they didn't get to control of the exchange. So the authorities were able to phone one another and basically coordinate the campaign to subdue the rebellion, because they could phone. So the police and the army and everything were still in touch over the phone, and that helped subdue the rising fairly quickly. Now, it didn't work into the British in the end, their advantage, because not outside of the telecom sphere, a few weeks later, a general came in and ordered the execution of all the leaders. That changed, and that Irish people love a martyr. So suddenly we had all these war martyrs, and public opinion suddenly changed radically against the British and in favor of Irish independence. And that was the end of it, really, from the British point of view. But the fact that the authorities were able to use the telephone service in particular to keep in touch with one another during the week of the while the rising lasted, that meant they were able to, coordinate the case against it.
You know, from this side of the Atlantic, I think it's so the establishment of communications with Europe was so important. And I think about Valencia Island.
Yes.
And can you tell our listeners about the importance of Valencia and
Yeah.
that area down in Southwest Ireland and Kerry?
Yeah.
And how it figured so prominently in communications around the world.
So if you think of a map of Europe, there's Ireland is right out on the west, and along with like Portugal or whatever. So it's an obvious point. If you want, it's the shortest point to the North American continent. So the story goes that this New York, I think, paper tycoon, like print paper manufacturer, Cyrus Field, had received a visitor who had this idea of building a telegraph line all the way to Newfoundland from New York. And the story goes that Cyrus Field, when the visitor had left, Cyrus Field looked at the globe in his very nice home in I think it was Gramercy Park in New York, and spun it and went, looked at the at sort of a Newfoundland. If you can go for New York to Newfoundland, for Newfoundland to Ireland actually isn't that much further. So why not just go the whole way? And that's what this man Cyrus Field tried to do for several years. It was absolutely at the cutting edge of technology, at the point when he was looking at the globe, the longest expanse of water that had been crossed by a telegraph cable was the English Channel, which is only about 25 miles across. There's something like, I think, 1,800 miles, nautical miles across the Atlantic, even at the shortest point. But it meant that because this was absolutely cutting-edge stuff, the shorter the cable, the better, the easier and the less risk. So that's why it went from Newfoundland to Kerry, because that was the closest point. So Kerry is the southwest corner of Ireland, it's the nearest point in Ireland to the North American continent.
You know, when we visited there back in 2004, we were traveling with my mother and my wife's mother, and the fellow that was our guide intended to take us out to Valencia Island, and we sat at this gate waiting for the ferry to mm-hmm. take us across. Only to learn after sitting there for an hour that the next ferry would only be there in the next spring.
So
they closed the ferry for the winter, yes. And our guide was not aware of that. So we never actually got out to Valencia Island, but we made an attempt.
Right. Well, Valencia is lovely. So it hasn't been an island technically since 1967 or something. So they built a bridge at another part of onto the mainland.
But it was going to be another hour's drive, I think, to get to that bridge.
But Valencia's we went again as part of the research. I went down, and it's absolutely charming. It's you know, the southwest of Ireland gets the benefit of the best that the Gulf Stream can bring. So it is quite mild. So it'd be very unusual to get anything like frost or snow down there. So the vegetation where it's sheltered from the wind is quite lush, and it's really very pretty, and it's on a quite a sheltered bay. So that's one of the reasons why Valencia was picked, in particular of all the different places in Kerry. So it was apparently because of the sheltered bay, so it was a good place to bring a cable on shore. And there was also a local landowner there, the Knight of Kerry, who was quite keen and developed a relationship with Cyrus Field, the New Yorker who I just mentioned. He wasn't completely altruistic. He owned a lot of the land, so if he wanted to negotiate with the landowner to put in equipment this would be the man you'd be paying rent to. But anyway, he was also trying to promote employment and so on, and the cable stations eventually did become very big sources of very well-paid employment for many decades.
Well, it took several attempts to get a reliable cable
it
across.
It did, So they, I mean, again, you have to admire Cyrus Field's perseverance, because they made, I think it was the fifth attempt before it was successful. That was 1866. There was a previous one was successful for a few weeks, but it was quite unreliable and it just failed eventually after a few weeks.
The insulation material that was used to insulate the wires was a real technological challenge.
Yes, absolutely. They discovered, and it was actually an Irishman involved in this discovery, that there was a material called gutta percha. So there's a tree in Glows in Southeast Asia. And it's like rubber, but it's not the same as rubber. And they could use that then to insulate it, but it didn't degrade in salt water. That was the thing, whereas I think rubber does. So gutta percha didn't, and that was the revolution that found it. But it was still, in the mid-1800s, to get pure copper that didn't have a break or impurities in it, that was produced for, you know, in strands, to make sure that the gutta percha insulation didn't have a break in it to let water in. To make sure that it was sufficiently armored so that ships' anchors and fishermen's nets wouldn't damage it. But the main, with any submarine cable right down to this day, the main problem is that at the shore ends, that you might think that in the middle where it'd be rougher is the problem, but actually the danger is at the shore ends, where simply ships' anchors still cause problems to this day, can snag can cut a cable. And that was a problem for them.
Well, skipping forward even to today, they're continuing to lay cables across the ocean.
Absolutely.
Only now we're doing fiber optic cables.
Correct, yes. So they started laying fiber optic cables, I think, in the we moved to fiber optics in the 80s, and they've just been continuing to lay them ever since. And so as the technology improves, typically every cable, you know, has maybe higher capacity than the one that was laid a few years before. And so Ireland's remarkably well connected. However, we do have some, I think there are some transatlantic, but most of the cables landing in Ireland are just connecting us to Britain and from there to the rest of Europe. There are some, there's a few, there's one or there's, there are some Atlantic ones as well. But they don't go out of Kerry because they come out of other parts of Ireland. And the reason is simply nowadays the length isn't quite as important as it used to be. So
Yes, right.
if it makes sense to bring it perhaps nearer to a major on land it and maybe nearer a more central population center, you'll do that rather than bring it at the most, you know, rather than minimizing the sea crossing. So
Well, you
that.
know, in these days of wireless connectivity, you sort of don't think about how important the wire is still.
Yes.
You know, you make the point in your book about the latency.
Yes, for satellite.
That's embedded into satellite communications, and in fact, the conversation that you and I are having right now would be extraordinarily awkward
Yes, exactly.
if we were doing it by satellite communication.
Yes, and I think people sometimes forget that they don't you don't get that annoying lag on intercontinental phone conversations anymore because they've reverted back to cable, but now fiber optic cable. And that if you know people have this idea that oh their mobile phone somehow it all goes through the air. It goes through the air to the nearest base station, which might only be a few hundred yards or a mile away. And then if that base station is connected into the network, which probably is by fiber. And from there on, most of it is probably going by fiber optic cable somewhere just around. And you know, you could be accessing a website on the other that's been served on the other side of the world, and probably it's going a journey completely by fiber optic cable, possibly with submarine cables to that you know to that web server.
Well, you know, your book, I have to say, is as much about the technology as we have been just talking, as it is about the cultural history of Ireland. And I was struck by the fact that many Irish people did not have telephones in their homes, in spite of Ireland being really at the front edge of this international communications. It was
Yes.
way late until, and you tell the story of your own family
That's correct. Yes.
in the book. Now, am I correct? Your dad was a dentist?
That's correct. Yes.
And
Yeah. So,
tell that story a little bit
yeah.
about how you guys finally got a phone in your home.
So my father was a dentist. My father being from County Cavan and possibly related to you, Mark,
Right.
through his mother, from Ballyjane stuff. So my father was a dentist and had his surgery in his office in the middle of Dublin. And one day, well, so to set the context, we had moved house. When I was about six, we moved house, or we moved into a new house, which didn't have a phone. Now it had a wire coming into it, but there was no phone installed in the house. This was 1972, and at the time, you typically waited about 2 years to get a phone in. You filled in a form and you might get a letter back acknowledging it and no you would know we would never commit to a date and eventually you might get another letter maybe you know 1, 2, 3 years later to say we you know we're now in a position to install your phone and you can expect so on and that was the way it was. So my mother in particular was not happy about this, but so anyway we're in this new house. We've been there a month or two, no sign of a phone, probably we're expecting to wait 2 years. And a man arrives in with toothache, and he's already been into my father's patient. So my father has his records, and the man is ushered into the surgery, put into the chair. Chair leaned back. My father looks at his chart and goes, "Employer, P&T, which means the Department of Post and Telecommunications, which is the Post and Telegraphs, which is the government department at the time responsible for telephones, amongst other things." And basically, the man says to this patient, "Is there anything you can do to get our phone in?" And the man says, "If you sort out my toothache, I'll try and sort out your phone." And a deal was struck in the dental chair. And within weeks, a phone was installed. Now, of
That's
course,
terrific.
It didn't work for a few months, but that's another story. But and those sort of stories were not uncommon.
Well, those sorts of interpersonal connections are always key to getting things done. That's true everywhere, isn't it? That's the international language. You know, I think there are several takeaways in your book, and you mentioned the Department of Post and Telegram.
That's correct. Post and Telegraph, yes.
Telegraph.
Yeah.
And one of the takeaways that for me in reading your book was the choice that Ireland made after gaining independence to keep the control of this important technology and infrastructure within the government's
control
part of a government service.
Yeah. Well, and that was actually quite normal. Most countries, I think, did that. The US and Canada and a few others, Cuba and Spain and Peru, I think, had got private, where the telecommunications services was run by the private sector. But in most countries and almost everywhere in Europe, apart from Spain, it was run by government.
Right.
And
we would have Bell Telephone here.
Yeah, yeah.
And AT&T then. Yeah.
Yeah, but in most countries until the 90s, it was a government. It was owned by the government, and it's hard to say because I you know there's sometimes a political thing here. You know. I think wasn't there always this saying in the US, look at the US, that by people, particularly on the right, who'd say, oh, look at the mail service, it's government owned, and your mail takes ages, and the phone service, you can get a phone in immediately, and that's private sector. It's not quite as simple as that, because Spain didn't have a fantastic service either, and it was private owned by IT&T, actually an American headquartered company. And it was a bit better than Ireland, but not noticeably better. But Ireland's problems were particularly severe because the government just didn't prioritize it. So the government had lots of people looking for, lots of different areas that need to be invested in. The country had, you know, in terms of infrastructure, the country had, there was a very bad problem of housing in Dublin. There was slums that needed to be cleared, people needed to be housed, on hospitals and built and so on. So they had lots of people looking for different things to look at for, and they didn't prioritize telecommunications. And by the 1950s, really, this was becoming a liability because they were making a shift to encourage industrialization and foreign investment. And, well, what did foreign investment want to do was to try and keep in touch with the head office in the US or wherever. And, you know, the state of the Irish telecommunications service did not make that easy. And it did actually become, by the 70s, was a barrier that companies wouldn't move to Ireland, it was felt, because of the poor state of telecoms. And at that stage, they decided to move it from being a direct government department to being what we would call a semi-state. So it's a company which is owned by the government, but operates on a commercial level, on a commercial basis. So it's independent. And the main thing is that it has its own kind of cash flow, profit mm-hmm. and loss. So it mm-hmm. can invest the way it wants. It doesn't have a government minister sort of saying, oh, you must install phones there because that's where that's a marginal constituents for us and we're trying to win votes there. No, it operates on a largely commercial basis. And things improved, by orders of magnitude at that point.
Well, it's interesting reform led the way to a lot of improvement. And then,
yes.
then at this, you know, along the way comes cell service and wireless technology.
Yeah.
And with so many people without phones in their home, that was already made
market
for, yes, for people that needed service.
Yes, exactly. So there was still, even in some parts of the country, even until the early 1990s, there was a waiting list for phones. So it wasn't 2 years, but it might take weeks or months because there was just such a backlog of people waiting. And the service was also expensive. So compared to the US, or most of Europe, it was quite expensive. So a lot of people got used to not having a phone at home. So, you know, at a time when I'm sure in the US it would have been 99% of homes would have had a phone in the early 90s, and it would have been the same in Sweden. You know, maybe a little bit lower in Germany or the UK. We were at like 75%, that sort of level. So there was still a large number of homes that didn't have a phone. And then mobile came in, and then what one of the actually the first cell phone company here did was bring in I think it was 1998, 99, bring in prepaid, the concept of prepaid phones. Now, on US movies, they always turn out to be the murderer or whatever is always the one with the prepaid phone. But prepaid phones in Ireland were perfectly respectable things to have, and lots of people went out and got them. And it meant that you didn't have to go through some sort of, credit risk assessment. But more importantly, you didn't have that fear of a bill at the end of the month or whatever that,
Right,
phones
right.
were regarded as expensive, cell phones were regarded as particularly expensive. If you had a prepaid one, you just put some credit onto it, and then if it ran out, that's fine. But you were still. But the interesting thing is, in Ireland and in Europe, you're still reachable. So, I know in the US, some plans you paid for incoming calls. That never was the case here.
Right.
You never paid for it. So that meant you could have a phone, and even though there was no credit on it, you were still reachable in the event of an emergency. And the people just took them like ducks to water. So I think it was around 2000, the number of cell phone lines exceeded the number of landlines in Ireland, and that was we were one of the first countries in the world where that happened. And it took many years for the US to do that, mainly because the US had a much higher proportion of people and homes and businesses with landlines.
Derek, as we traveled in Ireland, I guess it's been 3 years ago when we met you, 3 or 4 years ago. And as Americans do, we all had the iPhones with us each, and getting driving directions from place to place with the iPhone. And even in America, there are places that we were just in Florida, and we lost cell service a couple times because we were in such a remote place. I don't recall ever losing service, and as we traveled around Ireland, so y'all have jumped up in technology leaps and bounds.
I mean, remember that Ireland, it's there's only 5 million people in the Republic. There's less than 7 million people on the whole island. But there aren't huge areas of wilderness. There's typically one of this is a problem for broadband, actually, and for telecoms, and particularly rolling out broadband or fiber broadband. The rural population is quite dispersed, so you'll get houses. Farmers will live on the land, so they'll a house will be built to serve a farm, and also maybe he'll sell off some land, and people will build a house on the road. So it's quite even in areas that are considered quite remote, there are still people living there. Obviously not on the top of mountains, but
Right.
There aren't, as I said, there aren't huge wilderness areas in Ireland. So as a result, that the cell phone coverage has to be reasonably good because there are people everywhere, or almost everywhere.
I guess the most remote place that we got to on our trip was a place called Bell Mullet, which you mention in your book because it
Which
because of
features in the
its
book,
remoteness, and way out in, is
County
it County
Mayo.
Mayo? Yeah.
That's right.
But we even in that remote place, we were able to get good service.
But if you drove from Belmullet, there's a for just the very end of the world, there is a place called Blacksod, which features in the book, and it was the most westerly weather station in Europe during the Second World War, which is why it ends up in the book. But there is quite a lot of people living there. There's quite a lot of houses. It's surprising because it is almost the furthest you can get from Dublin, but there's quite a lot of people living there. So I was surprised at the number of houses around.
Well, a cute little fishing village out there
And
in the
Belmullet as a
west.
town was well, I was surprised how thriving it was. It was a busy little place.
One of the other wonderful stories in your book is the story, and this reaches back to Cavan and the Irish national championship football, Irish Gaelic football championship. Which was played in New York City.
That's right.
Tell us that story.
Well, there's a little bit of personal interest in this one because, okay, I'm not a big sports fan, because my father was from County Cavan, this was just one of these childhood stories was that in 1948, the All-Ireland football final. So in Ireland we have this form of football called Gaelic football. So Ireland and it's not it's an unu it's not really played anywhere else. There's something similar in Australia. Australian rules are similar, so it's
That's the closest thing I can think of. It's played with a round ball, like a soccer ball. Australian football is played with an oblong ball, like an American football.
But you can, but unlike soccer, I mean, you can handle the ball. That's allowed under certain circumstances. And so, but it's tremendously popular. It is it's probably more popular here than soccer or rugby or whatever. So, and it's played right across the country. But in 1948, for some, and I don't know the history as to why, but you can imagine that it's the war is over and maybe people are starting to, celebrate a bit and travel a bit. But there are two. So every year, there's a championship for there's 32 counties in the country, and the 32 counties will all go through and play one another, and eventually two will go head to head in the final, which is normally at the in early September. And in 1948, the teams I think were Kerry and Cavan. Cavan was and still is. It's quite unusual for them to get to the final. It's not a particularly populated county, so they have that problem. And that year, it was played in the Polo Grounds in New York. I have no idea why, but normally it would be played in there's a stadium in Dublin called Croke Park, which takes 80,000 people. But this year, that particular year in 1948, it was played in the Polo Grounds, and that was quite a logistical challenge for a country with poor telecommunications to get commentary and pictures from New York to Dublin. So to get the pictures, one of the newspapers in Dublin installed an early fax machine in 1948, and they were able to get from from the press agencies, they were able to get photographs of the match sent over, and then they were printed in time for the following morning's papers, which I imagine sold very well in Cavan, because of course the most important thing is that Cavan won that
Kevin
match.
won it, absolutely. I suppose, Derek, they're between Boston and New York, there are probably more Irish people of Irish descent than in Ireland today.
Yes.
Probably was true back in 1948 as well.
Yes. I'm sure they
The
had
Irish are
no
all over the
problem filling.
world.
Absolutely, I'm sure they had no problem filling the Polo Grounds in New York with the
So
spectators.
I'm just thinking some American promoter just decided, hey, we've got to bring it here. That would be great fun. I had no idea that that had ever happened until I visited Ballyjamesduff and saw about it in the Cavan Museum, where they have pictures of the team, and one of the boys on the on that on that winning championship team was a Conway, as noted in the picture.
My father, like all Cavan people who were alive at the time, never stopped talking about it.
Well, and shouldn't, and shouldn't.
It was a very big deal.
Well, one of my regrets in visiting Cavan is not attending one of those games while we were there. I think the night that they had a game there was a little bit rainy, and the weather was not so terrific. So we watched the game in the bar in the hotel,
Of course.
and learned about the game a little bit from the folks there in the bar as well, because this was unfamiliar to me, the rules of Gaelic football.
And the other odd thing about it is it's an amateur sport. So even the people playing at that, who would have gone to a final, they're amateurs. They have jobs and they train in their own time. And it's a huge community involvement. There's because you'll have lots of parents coaching, children's teams, and it's a major kind of cohesive force for Ireland. And
The
yeah,
GAA, the
the
Gaelic
GAA, yeah,
Athletic
there it is. Yeah,
Association,
yeah.
right? It's all everywhere in Ireland.
Yes.
Well, Derek, I want to thank you so much for joining me today and having this rambling conversation. A little bit about your book, a lot about Ireland and its history, and encourage you to continue your family history research.
Thank you.
Derek, thanks again for joining me today.
Not at all, Mark. Thank you very much.
All right.